Welcome to the Innovations in Organic Ag podcast. I'm Kathleen Dellett, Professor of Organic Agriculture at Iowa State University. In this podcast, we want to highlight some of the many innovative organic farmers and scientists who work with organic farmers for the purpose of sharing their information and starting a dialogue on the value of these innovations. Contrary to many people's beliefs, organic farmers keep up with the latest technology and weigh its particular value in their operations before recommending it to others. To start off, we're talking with Seth Harbeck, who farms organically with his father in Sycamore, Illinois, which is 1 hour east of Chicago in the fertile prairie soils of central Illinois. Seth and his father have utilized a smartphone and computer-based app to collect, store, and analyze their individual fields' data to help them make better decisions about their farm. Seth, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself, your life at Iowa State, and your plans post-graduation, please?
So I came to Iowa State, say, 3.5 years ago now, and I came for agricultural biochemistry, and I'm also minoring in agronomy. I've learned a lot, and it's been a lot of fun. It kind of went different directions than I might have planned at the start, but I have, I think, a pretty good foundation now in biology and chemistry and microbiology and plant science. So it's been fun and I've learned a lot. I'm also just really excited to return to the farm in May and to be an organic farmer with my dad. So I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. Well, can you tell us a little bit about your farm? How many acres, what crops you grow, how long you've been certified organic?
Yeah, so we farm about 2,000 acres, rotation between corn, soybeans, and oats. And we did wheat during our transitional period too. We first started transitioning in 2018, so almost 6 years now. I think this will be our sixth growing season this spring. And at this point, everything's certified. We kind of did it in chunks, but we're completely certified now. It's been a lot of learning, but a lot of good things too. So,
That's a lot of acres to manage. What tools have you used to help you manage all those acres? Can you name some of those?
couple things we've done is we use FieldView. That's kind of the main app that we store a lot of our yield information and field information. And then we do a lot of like data analysis with Excel and Google Sheets and then record stuff in Google Docs too.
Can you walk us through how FieldView actually works? Do you buy the program? Do you download it? And what are the parameters you enter and anything else you can think of to help an outsider understand that program?
So basically, it's a subscription that you purchase, and then it's an app that you download. You can download it on computers or your phone. And so, like, I'll have it on my iPhone. There's a lot of different aspects to it that can help us in the field. I might just get into it. A couple of things that it does is it stores our actual field boundaries, and therefore, it can calculate acres of your field. And it also has a lot of places where you can record data. So we connect it to our planter and our combine. And so it'll record what hybrids we plant in different spots very accurately. So we have a picture where different colors match up with a different hybrid. And you can see, oh, this is exactly where I planted this hybrid. This is where I planted this hybrid. And then similarly, it will calculate yield by connecting to the combine. And so in the fall, we'll plug it into the combine and then it'll upload our yield data, and it's kind of like this big rainbow of like red to green, where green is obviously high yield and red's low yield. And so you can see on your field map where you had different yields and stuff. Those are like two really helpful things, but there's a lot of other things too.
Sounds really neat. Will it graph some of the data too for you if you asked it for a graphical representation?
Yeah, so that's something where we'll use Google Sheets or something like that or Excel. I actually don't know if it can or not. Again, maybe what we've used it for, we haven't gotten to that spot. Honestly, the best part about it, or maybe a couple more things that are good, is that it calculates rainfall for each field. So if there's a significant rain event, or even insignificant down to the tenth of an inch, it'll tell you what field got how many inches of rain. And then we can upload that into like a Google Sheet or Excel. Or we can like have all that data in a spot that, okay, let's make a graph that says yield compared to our significant rain dates. Maybe even another cool thing too that we've used is you can pin locations on the map. So let's say that, we're hand weeding our field, in August, and we get to a giant section of cockleburr, and it's like, oh my gosh, this is a problem. I can get on my phone, pin it, and text my dad, hey, here's a pin of this spot. We're going to have to come back and get it. Or what happened here? You know, something like that.
Interesting. So where is it pulling the rainfall data from? Do you have to input that yourself?
No. So it's called Climate Field View. And so I think that's kind of one of the main perks to this subscription is that it calculates rainfall on its own, inputs it automatically. So that's like a serious draw. I think that it has maybe an upper hand in some other programs. And I think that's the reason my dad initially went for it was because, oh, we want to know when we're getting rain and how much and where.
Excellent. So by any chance, does it do anything with soils?
Yeah, that was kind of the next thing I was thinking about. So it also has soil types for all your fields. It has soil types for everywhere. And then, you know, your field has a little chunk out of their big map. And so then you can say, oh, look, here's this soil type. Here's this soil type. And it has elevation too. And it can even sort, like, if you're looking at yield in the fall, you know, well, I want to see yield compared to this soil type, this soil type, this soil type, or this elevation, you know. And so it has the ability to sort data too, which is pretty complex and honestly something that we haven't used a ton just because that data is pretty, I would say, complex.
Exactly. Something to do in the winter. Oh, it is winter.
Yeah.
You can look at it now. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Do you think the program has helped you manage the farm better and in what way?
Yeah, I definitely think it has. I think that pin thing is the most useful, just like practical thing. Maybe another example would be, let's say I'm rotary hoeing in the spring and I'm like, oh, I think I was a little hard on our beans here. It looks like I dinged them a little bit. I don't know, though. It's going to be hard to tell. Well, let's pin it. I'll write a note. I was going a little aggressive here. I want to see what it looks like in a month or a week. And then I pin it. Then we can come back in a month or a week and we can be like, okay, they turned around. They're fine. Let's do it again. Let's kill these weeds. Or it's like, I think we might have hurt them a little bit. Let's maybe back off on our aggression a little bit. And you know, you can do that for any field work, really. Spring tillage, fall tillage, row cultivating, rotary hoeing. It's pretty applicable, I would say, for sure.
That sounds wonderful. Do you know if there are any other programs out there doing similar things?
Yeah, I know there definitely are. I'm not super familiar with the other ones because, you know, I haven't necessarily been involved with them. But I know like AgWorld and Conservice are two big ones. I really just know the names. I don't like know a lot about them. I know John Deere has like an operation center. It's called like when you have a John Deere tractor, now it automatically uploads data. And so that's another one that I think a lot of people use because you can map your boundaries and then pretty similarly to FieldView, you can input notes and work dates and all that.
I didn't ask about this earlier, and if you don't know the answer, no worries, but would you know approximately how much it would cost to have a subscription to this?
I actually don't. I should have looked that up, but I did not.
Because your father pays for you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But you could look it up. I bet they're not trying to hide it.
Exactly. Yeah, we can do that. Add to it. Great. Thank you so much for all this information. Is there anything else you want to add about this app?
I think the only thing I would add is that it's pretty unique, and I think you can do a lot of different things with it, depending on, you know, even just your personality, like what you want to learn about. And so I think it's going to be different for each person. That's how we've used it. And maybe someone else would be like, what? I've never used that. Or, you know, I've done all these other cool things. So I think, yeah, it comes down to your operation and what you want to do, what you want to learn.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us today in our Innovations in Organic Ag podcast. Next, let's tackle weed management innovations. Today, we're talking with Levi Lyle, who farms organically with his father in Keota, Iowa, in southeast Iowa, about an hour south of Iowa City. Levi's been experimenting with organic no-till and weed zapping for about 5 years, and we're excited to talk to him today. Levi, welcome to the show.
Good to see you, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Levi, can you start us off? Please tell us a little bit about your farm, how many acres total, how many organic acres, what organic crops you grow, and how long you've been certified.
Mm-hmm. I farm here in Keota, Iowa with my father, and I have about 250 acres. He farms nearly the same. Together, we have 60 acres of organic certified ground, and that is a collaboration between my father and I. It's been an opportunity for me to hold his hand as we embark on some of these really valuable farming that I'm excited about. I returned to the farm about 11 years ago, and so he has helped me kind of get my bearings into the way the farm operation works, and I've helped him to get into this organic side of things.
So what crops do you grow, Levi, that are certified, and how long have you been certified?
Well, for 12 years, I've been growing organic certified aronia berries. That's a whole separate podcast. We might do that sometime. But for 5 years, I have been organic. So when you include the transition in that, which will come up today, because some of the things we're talking about work so well in transition. I was an organic inspector for a couple years. So that was kind of segue to beginning to transition the row crops into organic. So corn, soybeans, and small grain are the focus of my row crop production.
Great. So Levi, you've been an innovator when it comes to equipment and soil conservation on your farm. Can you tell us a little bit about the Weed Zapper? How does it work and how did you come to know about it?
When I was doing organic inspections, it was really interesting because I would hear whispers about using electricity, and I didn't see a weed zapping machine in action, but I would sometimes come across fields that the farmer would say, oh, you know, I manage this with electricity. And it was fascinating to me to think that was even possible. With a little bit of research, I found out the technology to use electricity, high voltage, in weed management has been around for longer than I've been alive. So, you know, more than 40 years. And the thing is electricity, of course, has to be used with caution. And it wasn't until here in the last 10 years that a company called Old School Manufacturing, and there are some other companies out there promoting these products too, but Old School Manufacturing has purchased this technology and developed many, many safety features. And that gives a lot of confidence in this technology breaking into the mainstream. So we'll talk about some of those safety aspects today, but I was able to rent a machine to use on my farm. And a year later in 2018, I purchased a machine and started doing custom work in the area. And that was great segue to help pay for the implement, of course. But now we use it more and more local all the time. Each year I'll do a little bit of custom work for some people, but at this time I'm mostly using the machine on my own farm.
So because I don't understand it all, can you give a little more detail about how it works? There's a generator on the machine and turn it on and out the electricity flows?
Yeah, so the PTO generator on the back of the tractor is a generator that you might see going down the road when you drive past the farm, because these generators are about the size that it takes to run a farm. Often it's a hog farm around here. And so you've got the generator component, which is a 480 volt generation system, and you've got a transformer back there that can output 20,000 volts. So the power that is used then travels through a copper wire up to the front of the tractor, where you have the copper bar, which is across horizontally. And you have hydraulics, and it's best when you have hydraulics in the front of the tractor to be able to lower and raise that bar. Because when you're going through a field, what you want to do is keep that copper bar as close to the canopy as possible without touching your crops, but where weeds are stretching up above your crop.
And is it instant zapping? Do you actually see the plants wilt as you go by, or does it take hours to take effect?
It is absolutely instant. When you touch the plants, they're immediately drooped over. You're basically boiling the cells inside of those plants. And for that reason, it's the succulent plants like ragweed or mare's tail, cuckleburrs. It really works on anything, but the more succulent the plant, the better. And so we'll go through the field. And when we come back through the field 5 minutes later, you can see where you have gone. Those weeds are just completely drooped over. And then in the days that follow, those plants dry out.
Excellent. So that was my next question. At what stage of growth use it in the plant? And primarily you're only used on soybeans so far?
I recommend it with soybeans. You can use weed zappers in lots of settings. I've heard about farmers using them to terminate a field of alfalfa or a field that's in fallow that they want to just run it close to the ground and clean it up to do some no-till organic. The secret to that is to go slow and take your time and make multiple passes in the case of going over something like alfalfa that is an established crop. But I do not have experiences in many of those situations. I've used it on CRP ground to take care of some thistles and stuff like that, just playing around to assess what it'll do, and it terminates anything. I forget the rest of your question
there. Well, I was going to say, when you're going through the soybean field, you're not doing it when they're 6 inches high. At what stage are you sapping the weeds in the soybeans, for example?
Exactly. Good question. So it's really a way for the weeds to stretch up above the canopy. If I'm doing custom work, then a farmer doesn't want me to come into their field too early because more weeds will just come if things haven't reached up above the canopy. So waiting until mid-July is sometimes the best situation for going into another farmer's field. In my field, I can come in early July and start to get those weeds that are just poking up, and then I can make a second pass or a third pass, and it's only my own cost and time. But I like to wait until mid to late July, and then even into August, it works really well. When you get into late August, any of the weeds are going to start to turn more cellulosic. And so something that weed zaps really great, like ragweed all summer long, will be harder to kill in late August because it is just more stemmy and cellulosic. And so you just have to go slower and get a greater contact time on weeds when it comes to that point.
I appreciate you sharing all these tips with us. I imagine it does take a couple times or years actually to learn how to operate it most proficiently. What about safety concerns? You mentioned that school manufacturing is really stepped up its game on that, but are there any other safety concerns you want to put out there to the audience?
Well, there's explicit signs on the implement that say to stay 50 feet back. That, you know, when you're dealing with high voltage electricity, there's just that necessity. But also there's motion sensors on the implement and then speed sensors. So you have to be going 1.5 miles per hour for the implement to kick on before you can put power to it. So I get a rolling start into the row because you have to, you know, be moving. Then you hit your on button and the power starts. And then if you're going too fast, say, I believe it's like 5 mile an hour, the computer will shut off the power. So there's just that range that you have to be going in. And so that's the safety mechanism. And then you've got a grounding coulter on the outside of the implement, which actually completes the circuit. If you think of that electricity coming in contact with the weeds, then the charge goes to the soil and it has to come over to the grounding coulter to complete the circuit. Some of the complicated situations I've observed are if you're in a field where a farmer has row cultivated recently, or there's just a lot of dirt clods in it, that coulter on the outside might be bouncing along and cause that circuit to be broken. And then the computer kicks off. And so there's little things like that that are just, it just takes some experience to figure out, like, okay, how am I going to get past this little obstacle that is being a nuisance? But it's like any piece of equipment. It's a tool that works really well, but there's always problem solving for situations where it's just not quite exactly what you need. Also, I'll just mention, because there's all these little details, in any given field, a farmer might have 36 inch rows or 38. And so then, you know, having a tractor that has the tires that are spaced is one thing, but also your coulters on the outside of the implement, which is your grounding coulter, it may need to be moved. So you loosen some pulls, you slide it in or out, and then you're set up for that particular field. But soybeans is really the crop that works ideal with my setup.
Dr. Craig Chase here at Iowa State did an economic analysis using a custom zapping rate of $40 an acre and found that it definitely paid off when you have a moderate or greater than moderate level of weeds. How does this correspond with what you found on your farm or other farms economics-wise?
Mm-hmm. That sounds about right. If I could accomplish 10 acres per hour, then I have been willing to do custom work for $50 per acre. So that's been kind of the sweet spot. You get into a field with heavy pressure, then the machine slows down significantly. You end up going 2 miles an hour, and then it takes more time. And if you're doing 5 acres per hour instead of 10, then the economics are completely different.
Right. What about on your own farm? Have you analyzed it economically, i.e. have you compared where you weed zap versus non-weed zap for economics?
Well, the comparison that I did that was really crunching the numbers was with you, Kathleen, on the Iowa State organic no-till test plot. So we saw that there was significant improvement in yield where we ran the weed zapper. On the rest of my fields, on the greater 60 acres of my organic field, it's been very apparent that the weed zapping has helped manage the weeds. I also use high residue row cultivation on that field because I have had foxtail issues. Foxtail is tricky because it doesn't reach up above the canopy, but that's the complementary implement that also goes along with my operation to keep my soybeans clean.
Mm-hmm. So you'd be using that high residue cultivator a couple weeks ahead of weed zapping, or how does it fit into the schedule?
Yeah, definitely a couple weeks before I would be able to get in there with the weed zapper. And so this last year, we ended up in a drought because we didn't get rain once we got to mid-July. If you recall, we had a field day on the test plot that we were working on together, and my soybeans looked excellent at that point in time, about a foot tall. A little early for weed zapping, but I had already high residue row cultivated them. A month and a half later, my soybeans were the same size. It was such a disappointment to see the way the rain had affected soybeans. And while I had roller crimped rye on the entire 60 acres of my organic soybeans, that had helped lock in moisture, which did my soybeans a lot of good. But still, the elements of weather are difficult to deal with.
I know. I don't know if this will make you feel better or not, but at the Moses conference last weekend, I was hanging out with some friends from Montana, and their drought was so bad that they harvested less grain than what they actually sowed. So I thought we had it bad, but I think you probably harvested more soybeans.
So, you know, we can talk about weed zapping as one of my primary tools, but in general, the organic no-till has been a great system on my farm because partially the roller crimping, which I realize isn't our main topic today, but the roller crimping in transition allowed me to maintain my regular soybean yields during transition. You know, we have other GMO fields. I'm a parallel organic farmer, so we have a GMO field across the road, and we usually yield about 50 bushels an acre for soybeans, and in transition to also still get 50 bushels an acre because of roller crimping rye before planting soybeans. It was just a wonderful way to transition in. Mm-hmm. And then that was before I owned the weed zapper, and I had really clean beans after transition. The roller crimping was a great system to keep the fields clean initially. But then as the weeds started to percolate into my field, the weed zapper became a tool that was a perfect fit to start to address that.
Well, you've segued right into our next topic of organic no-till. And as you know, we at Iowa State have been experimenting with organic no-till since 2005. I can say we're still perfecting it. Our ratio of successful years to less than successful is about 60-40. But I've observed excellent responses to organic no-till on certain farms, including yours in 2020. You walk us through how you do organic no-till, your cover crop, when it's planted, which roller you use, when you roll, when you plant.
Mm-hmm. Well, in answering that question, it's interesting because I've realized that it's easy to just jump ahead and start talking about my method of when I seed the rye and when we roller crimp and when we plant the soybeans. But I think it's really important to back up and look at what that system has been. And my father was a no-tiller for almost 30 years on the field where we are organic. And so he has always been since I was in grade school, he was doing no-till. So that increases the soil organic matter and cares for the soil in a way that I think perfectly prepares to transition into organic. Then we had gotten in on all the energy in around here in Washington County and Keokuk County. There is a lot of cover cropping. And about 10 years ago, there was a bunch of energy and excitement in this area about no-tilling, and farmers were very aggressive in this area to get in there and do some cover cropping. So we cover cropped for a couple years on this field that we then began transitioning to organic. So doing cover crops prior to transitioning really starts to get the biology going in that soil. And this is backed up by a lot of research also, that cover crops, especially multi-species cover crops, and if there's livestock in the system, you know, now you've got this healthy soil that you have as your starting point in organics. And from there, you can go into organic no-till and have better success. So I didn't realize all that was going on when I started transitioning to no-till. I was kind of fortunate just to stumble into this because my dad had already been no-tilling and then we had done some cover cropping. So I had that going for us in the start of this operation. So Kathleen, back in 2005, I was just a couple years out of college and learned about you and what you're doing at Iowa State. I met you for the first time and saw that you guys had access to a roller crimper. And I was so excited at that time to learn about roller crimping. So that was the beginning of the journey for me. It was another 10 years before I was back on the farm and ready to transition to organic. So a lot happened in between that time, including being an organic inspector, which helped me deepen my knowledge of organics. So then when I started doing organic no-till, I had a lot of confidence in the system that I was undertaking. So seeding the rye as early as possible in September or early October is very important because you want that rye to get a good establishment. 2.5 bushels per acre on the seeding is what we use. We would use 3 if we could push it out of the air seeder that we use, but 2.5 bushels an acre is sufficient. Farmers use 1 and have success if they can get it out and establish, because then that rye will tiller. It's not often said in the recommendation to short your amount of rye, because in an organic system, this is your primary weed management tool. So you don't want to mess around. You want to make sure you have the rye population out there to make sure you're going to have a good stand. So once we have a good stand of rye, then in the spring, we can come in and roller crimp. First, I'm going to mention my one pass roller crimping approach, because we have had a lot of success in that, and it's really an exciting, successful method. We started out with the roller crimping by having the roller crimper up front on a front hitch on the tractor, and then we would have our 15.5 foot drill on the back of the tractor, and we would plant soybeans and roller crimp rye at the same time. And this has been a wonderful way to plant our crop, because we go out there one time, we get it all done, and then there's no more work to do out in the field. As I mentioned, in more recent years, I have the weed zapper, I have the high residue row cultivation. And so these are very relevant tools now. But in transition, my beans were so clean, it didn't matter. It was just crazy to go out there one time, plant, roll, and then that was it until harvest. But I've learned with some experience that that's not always going to be practical. So there's the one pass approach. That would mean roller crimping in early June, most likely. But really what you're looking for is for your rye to enter anthesis, which is the pollen shed stage. And at least 50% of your rye needs to be in that stage. Otherwise, it will both pop right back up when you roll it down and it won't be dead. And then you'll have rye growing in your beans and that could affect your yield. And you won't have that mat laid down like a carpet, which inhibits the sunlight from touching the soil and suppressing weeds. You have all those elements that are reasons that you want to get the roller crimping right the first time. Now, there's another approach that we have had success in, and Kathleen, you observed this last year in our plot that we did together. This was going in and planting the soybeans in mid-May. May 12th, I think, was my planting date. So 3 weeks went by, and my soybeans were up growing beneath that rye, and the rye was still standing because the rye was in an early enough stage when we planted our soybeans that the rye didn't even go down. It was just growing, you know, like tender grass at that point. May 12th, we planted the soybeans. 3 weeks later, it was just entering that third trifoliate, which is about when the soybeans stopped being so brittle. So at that point, we were able to come in and roller crimp the whole field, and those soybeans that were coming underneath were just underneath there, and they then wound their way up through that ryegrass that was rolled down. And we had great success with that. And because of that month and a half with no rain in midsummer, it turned out to be a real blessing that we were able to get our soybeans out there early and growing, because there was a neighbor who did not plant early. He did the same time, which is the usually recommended approach for roller crimping and planting. And his soybeans were smaller and less developed when that drought came. So it did hurt him more so than it hurt me. So those are just some really interesting components, and it has worked well also to do that early planting of soybeans and later rolling.
So it seems like it's very site dependent, year dependent. If you had to speculate what you think your greatest success is correlated with, for me, I would say weather, number one, but I don't know what your thinking is on that.
Yeah, it's definitely weather. And also, there's a few things I've realized that just work better. So number one, this last year, I shouldn't have waited so long to roller crimp. I thought my beans are growing underneath. I want them to get to the third trifoliate. So the anthesis came and went the first week in June. And I thought, you know, what's the hurry? This is all working so well. I'll get in there in the next week or 10 days and do my roller crimping. Well, we should have just roller crimped when we usually roller crimp, because I waited just a little bit too long and that rye had developed enough that I had volunteer rye that still formed, even though it was laid down, it formed. So when the combine came through to pick up soybeans, it picked up some of that rye seed that was developed. And so I had an unusual amount of rye seed as foreign matter in my organic soybeans. So I had to clean them before I took them to my buyer. So, you know, that's an obstacle that was mainly just a nuisance, but it was something I hadn't experienced before because I hadn't ever held off on rolling that long. I just had confidence that it would all work so well, and it did, but I ended up with the volunteer rye. And when I say volunteer, I guess I don't mean volunteer. It was like the rye. It laid down and it had entered into the milk stage at that point, and those pods that were swollen up developed seed laying there on the ground. That was one element that I've learned. And another little trick, I guess, I've learned is instead of, you know, when you seed your rye and then you come in and you plant your soybeans along that same direction, sometimes you might be on top of a row of rye all the way through the field, and then your soybeans don't get put in the ground as well in some random row. So I've learned to seed my cover crop at like 3 degrees the whole way through the field, which makes it a little, you know, more detailed when you're out there planting your cover crop. But then when you come in with your soybean drill, you can go the way you want to go, just north and south or east and west, whichever, and know that you're not going to end up on a row where you had seeded rye all the way through the field. If you follow me, it's been a little trick, I guess, that definitely has helped the system. And then when you roll down rye, if you're just rolling in the direction that you seeded the rye, again, sometimes that rye doesn't stay down as well because it's just all pushing into each other as you're rolling down the row. But if your rye is seeded at a slight angle, now you're rolling it and it's coming down sideways, and it's almost like it makes a little weave pattern and all holds each other down. I've never heard anybody talk about this, but it's very apparent that it helps to have that little bit of an angle going on when you roll down rye.
Oh, neat. Well, thanks for sharing that tip with us. All right, we're coming to the end here. Is there anything else you want to add?
The outcome in improving soil organic matter has far exceeded what I ever imagined. We have found through soil testing that in 7 years of transitioning and then being organic, we've increased the soil organic matter by a full percent. That's 18,000 pounds of carbon per acre that we have added to this field. It's interesting to think back to when I was growing up, and you would often hear that it takes hundreds of years to add an inch of soil on the prairie as the buffalo and the wild areas of the Midwest were there. And I think science is showing that that's just not the case. We can increase soil organic matter very rapidly in the right conditions. So I'm continuing to explore more ways to amp up that system. I've got some ideas that we can talk about in future podcasts that I'm learning from other farmers, and it's very exciting. And it seems like there's still so much more we can do to continue to improve the biology of our soil, which will make yields better using less and less inputs. And of course, without chemicals and synthetic fertilizers. So when we talk again on this podcast, I hope we can get into some more of that.
Got it. Well, thank you so much, Levi, for talking to us today and sharing your innovations.
My pleasure.
Next, we discuss more precision ag innovations. We're talking to Scott Schreiber, who farms organically on 2,000 acres in Jefferson, Iowa, in central Iowa, about an hour west of Iowa State University. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Can you please tell us a little bit about your farm? How many organic acres? Is it all organic or some conventional too? What crops are grown and how long the farm's been certified organic?
Okay. Like you said, we farm about 2,000 acres. It's all organic. Our rotation is soybeans, corn, and then a small grain. One of those soybean years is a no-till application of the soybean, where after the small grain, we plant the rye and then plant soybeans into the rye the next year.
How long have you been certified organic?
We started converting those acres in 1998. It took us till, I think, 2008, and we were 100% organic at that point.
Excellent.
A little bit slowly, yeah.
So with all organic farmers, precision in planting and weed management is the key to success. I was wondering if you could explain to the audience about your real-time kinematic system, RTK, exactly what it is. Is it used for planting, weed management, and harvest? How does it work? Talk to me like I'm a third grader and explaining it, please.
Okay, I'll try. Feel free to stop me and ask for explanation. But we have an ag leader system. It's called a GeoSteer. And that is kind of the brains behind the steering and, you know, taking in the satellite information and everything. It's displayed on a monitor. And I'm kind of, these are the things you'd have to buy to, you know, to add this to a tractor. You'd have to have a monitor, basically your box or your brain that is that system. And then you have to have an antenna on top of your tractor that's receiving this signals from everything. The very basic system of guidance is called WAS, which is Wide Area Augmentation System. And that's where your system just communicates with satellites. And there's just tons of satellites up in the sky. There's ones that the United States has put out. There's ones the Russians have put out. And certain systems will take both. But that kind of guidance will give you what they'll call it plus or minus 4 inches accuracy, but it's and so pass-to-pass accuracy as opposed to continuous accuracy where like the next day you might come out and your WAS system that you were running the day before, you might be a couple of feet off, which a lot of times is okay. But for what we're doing, we feel we need the RTK, the real-time kinematic. So our system still receives everything that the WAS systems gives for free. This, you know, all that satellite stuff is just accessible to anybody's equipment. So we're adding the RTK, real-time kinematic, and that accuracy is considered to be, I think it's plus or minus an inch, but it's year to year. I mean, you get that same accuracy every year. And so our system allows us to store our guidance patterns. I think 15 years ago or more, I started and set up our guidance pattern. Like if our rows are planted east and west, we'll have one guidance pattern for the east-west rows and one for each field. And it's something you go out to your field and you say your first pass through, you set an A-B line. And you when you start, you hit A. When you go to the other end of the field, you hit B. And that's your A-B line. And that A-B line we've been using for 15 years, but it's the same thing every year, which the RTK gives us that kind of accuracy. But we've got a guidance pattern. So if we're planting east-west, that means we've got in rows on the north south. So we've set up those AB lines. We try to do everything in straight lines. We've got a couple of patterns that you can do curves, you can do identical curve. I mean, there's lots of different things you can do, but we try to keep everything straight just because I think that works better with the organics and the cultivators and things like that. So we've got guidance patterns for each field that are the same things every year and this RTK system.
So walk us through when you're planting. Is it physically moving your planter then when it receives a signal, or how does that work?
This system steers the tractor, and we've gone to a three-point mounted planter. So the tractor and the planter are pretty well hitched together, and that wherever the tractor goes, the planter goes. If you do have a hitch mounted planter with, say, even a long tongue, that planter will wander around a little bit on you. You know, it'll drift downhill if you're on a side hill. And that's why we've gone away from it, because obviously all of our cultivators and everything are also three-point mounted. you know, you have a little bit of sway in your three-point hitch, and we've done some things to tighten them up, but I think you could say that your three-point hitch is going to do the same thing with a planter as it does with a cultivator. So even if it drifts downhill a half an inch, if the planter drifts downhill, the cultivators are probably going to be drifting downhill also.
So can you see it actually making the corrections as you're going down the field?
You know, not really. It's pretty seamless, if you will. It just drives straight. And if you think you can drive straight, you can't until you realize what you've got with this RTK system. It's really phenomenal. And you don't want to feel those corrections. I mean, because it's correcting as it gets half inch off or even less than that. If you're feeling those corrections, then that means your tractor or your cultivator is moving side to side when you want that to be a perfectly straight line. So we plant with the RTK, and I think that gives us the benefit of having a straight row. So even if you weren't cultivating with RTK, if you were doing that, say, manually by, you know, your eyesight, at least you have a straight row to follow. So that was, you know, an initial benefit. And now, I mean, we cultivate with RTK. So we'll set it up. It isn't just push a button and never look at it again, but these RTK systems will have a nudge button. So if you set it up and you go and you feel like, well, we still keep a row marker and we use it as kind of a secondary, you know, when you turn your corners, we'll use that row marker to set up, you know, to get close and usually even to start out a little bit. If your tractor's not going the right, say if it's just got a heading that's slightly off of where you want to be and you hit your engage button on your guidance, it'll jerk you pretty hard to get you on, and you don't want to be cultivating while it jerks you. So you want to be heading kind of online and in straight where you want to go. Engage your guidance. That'll get you online. And we keep our nudge button set on a half an inch. So we can nudge right or nudge left a half an inch at a time. And it's funny, when you ask me if you feel it move the tractor, you can feel it that half an inch when you hit the nudge button. You just feel it a little bit. So the fact that you don't feel it when you're not nudging just tells you that tractor, it just stays online. It's always staying online and not moving. But we use that nudge button. And I'd say we're either nudging, I mean, it's either right on or we're nudging maybe a half inch one way and maybe up to an inch, you know, one way or the other. But I think that has... it's not so much to do with the accuracy of the system, but it's changing from tractor to tractor. We have four tractors. They all have guidance. You know, the cultivators, you know, we've got seven or eight different cultivators and rotary hoes and tine weeders that, you know, they might just all act a little different. So I think the nudge helps make up for those differences in tractors and equipment that we have to allow all of them to run straight.
Very interesting. So I would imagine then you wouldn't need it for harvesting because
you really don't need it. We have it on the combine. I feel like it keeps us on, especially the corn rows. I don't know. The whole guidance thing, it's almost like you don't know what you do without it anymore. And, you know, we lived without it for years and years and years. And you kind of thought, well, what do we need this for? But it's just really nice to have, and a lot of intangible benefits.
Well, you've sold me on it, but how expensive is it in general?
It's relatively expensive. A person would need to, you know, go to somebody that markets these things and price it, because it's going to have a different cost for different tractors. Older tractors are probably going to be a little more expensive because they weren't made, you know, in a time frame that they came auto steer ready. If they're, you know, 25, 30 years old, I would say about 20 years ago, then they started integrating some of the steering valves and things that was needed for the auto steer into the new tractors. And that progressed probably over time, where I'd say anything built in the last 10 years, I'm sure is, you know, guidance ready. So a little bit depends on your tractor. And then once you're guidance ready, then a WAS system is probably about $10,000 to $12,000. And that would get your monitor, your brain box, like in our case, it's the GeoSteer from Ag Leader. We run on Integra monitors from Ag Leader, and they're not they're out of date, really. They've had the new, what do they call it, the In Command for years and years. And I've talked to the people that are my suppliers of this system, and they're like, the newer monitors are nice. They can do different things. You can have split screens and more cameras and things like that. But from a standpoint of guidance, the system we have now is not any better with the new equipment. It's not any more accurate. It doesn't steer the tractor any better. So you know, I've kept with it and it's done good. So, you know, it's kind of expensive, but I think the system I have now has been in the tractors for 10 or 15 years. So, you know, lasts a long time. To get to RTK, it's probably about another $4,000. There's a little bit more, you know, you got the modem, but sometimes it's just an unlock that you have to have, and the unlock costs money. It seems a little ridiculous that when you buy your monitor, if all you want is WAS, your monitor is cheaper. But if you want to unlock your monitor to use RTK, there's an unlock fee, and it can be $1,000, $2,000. The systems haven't, they're about the same price as they were probably 10 or 15 years ago, which on one hand you could say, well, with inflation, you could say that's almost the price has come down. But I think, you know, technology's gotten cheaper over that time frame and everything, but at least, you know, it hasn't gotten more expensive.
True. Well, I don't know if you can answer my last question. How do you determine if it pays to have it? And maybe talk a little bit about farm size too, because the average size organic farm in Iowa is about 300 acres. So starting from there, do you think if you had a 300 acre farm, it would be worth it?
I think so. It's just tons of intangibles. But I believe that having the system, and if you're farming 300 acres, you probably can do it all with one tractor. So you just, you know, you're not talking about putting it on four tractors. You put it on one tractor, and we can set our cultivators closer to the row to do a better job with weed control. We can cultivate faster. Even as we're cultivating closer to the row, our speeds are increased. We have a lot less cultivator blight. And even though we're nudging once in a while, it's maybe once, maybe twice on a pass. But the rest of the time, you can turn around and look at what that cultivator is doing and not worry that you're going to wipe out your crop. Mm-hmm. So I think that allows you to do a better job cultivating, adjusting your cultivator, maybe your third link, you know, just to see what's going on back there. You can do a better job. So it doesn't take long, you know, in better weed control, doing a better job cultivating with our organic prices to make up for that. It's all a little bit intangible and hard to actually, you know, put a number by it, but I think it's worth it.
Well, thank you for sharing all this information with us. Is there anything else you want to add?
I can't think of anything unless you can think of any questions.
No, I actually understood it for a change. So thank you for explaining it in those details. So, well, thank you so much, Scott. We appreciate you sharing this information. Next, we move to innovative ways to preserve cover on the land while growing organic crops. Today, we're talking with Michael O'Donnell, who wears several hats, working with Living Prairie Family Farms in Walcott, Indiana, a 4,000-acre organic farm in Northwest Indiana. And now he's a crop specialist with Grain Millers in Marion, Indiana. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Can you start by telling us a little bit more about yourself, what you've been doing these last 5 years, and what you're doing now?
Sure. Yeah, I've been on a bit of a journey the last few years. But if we step back about 5 years, yeah, I was working as an organic agriculture specialist with Purdue Extension. That was a statewide extension position where I was tasked generally with supporting the organic farming community and the organic industry within Indiana, which is a really diverse, established part of agriculture in Indiana. We have a number of Amish communities, and that's where kind of what I considered the heart of organics in Indiana is based, in those communities, and where some of the original certified organic operations were in the state, and where some of the additional organic activity started to grow from. So a lot of organic poultry and laying operations and dairies in those communities that then started creating demand for organic grain. So in my role with Purdue Extension, in that organic specialist role, I made the decision to kind of focus in on supporting organic field crop production. There's obviously a lot of things in organics that I could have supported, but as a single person with limited resources and where the demand and a lot of the questions were coming from, I just kind of made the decision, like, this is where I'm going to focus and where I think I can have the most impact with my program. And so that was, you know, traditional extension programs, farmer meetings, conferences, field days, and then trying to lay the groundwork for more collaborative on-farm research with farmers, again, more in that field crop, row crop space. Yeah, and towards the end of 2020 into early 21, I made the decision to step away from my role with Extension and take on a unique opportunity with a farm, as you mentioned, Living Prairie Family Farm in Walkett, Northwest Indiana, about halfway between Indianapolis and Chicago, just a little bit off of Interstate 65. The farm was still in early days of transitioning some acres into organic. I think when I was getting to know Jason better, the farm owner, he had maybe 160 or so acres certified organic, had his first certified organic acres, which he took on already certified organic acres that he took on a lease, I think in 2016. And then the next year started transitioning acres into organic himself, like their home farm, and then another one after that. But I came on, he wanted somebody to help him get more organized with the organic certification stuff, all the record keeping. And as you can imagine, with an operation across 4,000 acres, 35 fields, you know, you got to be organized to maintain those records and communicate well with your certifier and think through the crop planning and the markets and how that big jigsaw puzzle is all going to fit together year to year. And so Jason invited me to join his operation. I came in, kind of worked with him hand in hand on thinking through crop planning, grain marketing, handling all the organic certification. I put record keeping systems into place and then also help with operations. In addition to the farm, he's got an equipment business called Living Prairie Equipment. So as he was retooling his operation from conventional corn and soybean into diversified organic cropping, he was asked by a lot of these equipment manufacturers, oh, you want to be a dealer? We don't have anybody in your area. And so he just sort of took on being a dealer with several equipment manufacturers and has this business, Living Prairie Equipment. So I also helped with equipment sales and parts ordering and all that kind of stuff with some of his equipment customers. So I continue to work for Jason, still handling his organic certification stuff, working with him on crop planning and thinking about market opportunities. But for some family reasons, I had to step back from being involved full time and being available for farm operations because the farm is a bit of a distance from where I live. So as I stepped away from that, I now find myself in a position with Grain Millers, and one of their facilities is in Marion, Indiana. It's a dry corn mill where they process organic, non-GMO, and conventional corn into things like corn grits, different sizes and specs, corn meals, and corn flours. So in this position, I'm kind of a field agronomist. The title is crop specialist, and so I'm supporting our suppliers of corn and oats. Corn's coming into Marion, and oats going out to St. Ansgar, Iowa facility there.
Sounds like you're busy. Well, the organic farmers are really lucky to have you around, Michael, with all your expertise and your willingness to share and help people succeed. We really appreciate that. Can you talk a little about the crop rotations on the Living Prairie Farm? How were the crops decided, and were the markets available for these diverse crops in the rotation?
Yeah, so at Living Prairie Family Farms, a big one is organic popcorn. That's been kind of a mainstay for Jason for several years now. Soybeans, mostly feed grade. A lot of different options where we can go with that. We've gotten into sunflower, both oilseed sunflower, and had one field of a con oil sunflower last year. The kernel is used for like a snack food, and that's a cross between a confectionery and an oilseed. What else? A lot of small grains. So raised winter wheat, soft red winter wheat, winter barley, winter rye, oats. Yeah, all those. And then tried some acres of a seed pumpkin. And that's for a snack food company, Top Fox. Have some more acres in that crop again this year. And lots of different cover crops. I think that covers all the cash crops. And then various cover crops in rotation. So in terms of the rotation, I often joke, or I don't know if it's a joke, it's just where the farm is at right now. There's not necessarily a set defined rotation that we stick to. I know a number of organic farms, they have a set rotation. They will never deviate. In the past, you know, you'll hear some of them talk about the times that I've deviated from my rotation. It always hurt me, right? But I think right now, you know, coming into this space with a lot of acres getting settled now, the whole farm this year, all but 12 acres will be certified organic. But, you know, just coming in with a lot of acres over the last few years and trying to piece together where the markets to support the diverse rotation that we want to see it's challenging. But I think also with this idea of having an adaptive, what I call an adaptive cropping system, we want to be somewhat responsive to the market opportunities, the things that we're seeing in terms of weed pressures or disease pressure or whatever it might be, nutrient cycling, you know, trying to fit this together, being responsive and observant of what we're seeing in the fields and matching that with market opportunities that might emerge. So rather than saying, okay, a third of our acres are in small grain, a third is in soybean, a third is in corn or popcorn, it's not quite that. But if you do look at the rotation the last couple of years, I would say about approximately a quarter of the acres are in various small grains. So again, that's oats, winter wheat, winter barley, winter rye. A half-ish is in summer row crops, maybe more. Last year was more, so that's popcorn, soybean, and the sunflowers. And then the remainder is in some of these other crops and cover crops.
Can you talk a little bit about which cover crops are in the rotation and how are they used? Or do you frost seed, do you plant interseed, or what's your schedule on that?
Two primary sort of places or approaches to cover cropping. So almost all of the acres coming out of popcorn, immediately after those fields are harvested, we will put cereal rye, winter rye out, just because of how flexible of a cover crop is. You know, if some of that popcorn's coming off late, we can still put something out there and know that we're going to get rye growth. So have a Valmar air seeder, so we can just zip across fields and blow cover crop out. I think it's a 60-foot boom onto the popcorn stalks. And then we'll just quickly zip over those fields with a Limpkin Heliodor. It's a speed disc, and knock down ridges if we have ridges from cultivating the popcorn and incorporate that rye. So it's a real quick, efficient way to get that rye out there and get ridges knocked down at the same time. And generally those acres would be going to soybeans the following year, or in some cases sunflower. But we're still kind of seeing how sunflower fits and where that makes sense in the rotation and cropping sequence. The other would be frost seeding clover, alfalfa, or mixes thereof into the winter small grains, you know, the barley, rye, and wheat. This winter, which we really haven't had much of a winter, we never really put a frost into the ground. We've been getting a lot of rain the last few weeks. You know, last week, I think we had 2.5-inch rainfall event. It's about 60 degrees here today. We haven't gotten anything frost seeded because it's been wet. It's going to be interesting to see when and how we get that out there. So with frost seeding, I mean, and we don't need the ground to be, you know, frozen solid. We just need it to be firm, because what we use is a different Valmar air boom. It's a pull behind Valmar 246, and just pull it with a pickup truck. So we can get out there and just zip across the field. It's got just a basic GPS kind of color bar thing that keeps you in your swath. And we just drop the cover crop out there and into the winter small grains. And sometimes it'll be straight alfalfa or straight red clover, but we've been playing with some mixes of different types of clover and alfalfa, and even a little bit of very small amount of some grasses, because we're curious about some of the carbon and nitrogen ratio on some of these cover crops. But with oats, we'll basically seed those mixes at the same time as the oats. So those are the two primary places where we get cover crops incorporated. We do also have some years with a full year of cover crop. So if there's a field where we just feel it needs to be a full year, what we call regen or soil build year, that might be a sort of a sequence of different cover crops, just depending on what that field's coming out of and what it's going to.
That's really smart. I think more farmers should look into that, because it probably can help with weed management too if you have some issues there. So just switching topics a little bit, as organic farmers, as you know, we're all striving for less tillage in our fields. And I attended your lecture at Practical Farmers of Iowa conference, and I'm remembering your experiences with organic strip till that you and Andy Klemp in Wheatfield, Indiana discussed. And I was wondering if you could explain to the audience first your system, then maybe a little bit about Andy's, because I know it's a little bit different, how that strip till system is set up. Are you going into cover crops or alfalfa? What commercial crops do you use strip till for? And when you plant the cover crops, when you plant commercial crops, everything there is to know about strip tillage.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and I definitely won't take credit for developing the ideas around this system. This comes from the mind of Jason Fetter, the farm owner, just has a mind for equipment and operations in row crops and comes up with some really unique ideas about how to manage these systems. And it sort of grew out of just, again, observation. I think observation of what, you know, really taking time to see what's going on fields and how can we adapt and change from year to year. So a field that was coming out of 2 years of alfalfa and into a first year organic back in 2020, just did a couple passes with a Lincoln Rubin, a kind of a heavier speed disc to try to terminate that alfalfa going to popcorn, first year organic popcorn. And great seedbed, planted popcorn, good stand, but then alfalfa started coming, right? So the passes with the Lincoln Rubin didn't fully terminate that stand of alfalfa, but it was okay, right? Could manage it, had good weed control. I mean, coming out of 2 years of alfalfa, not a ton of weed pressure. And Jason was able to, you know, manage that crop and get a good crop of organic popcorn. But, you know, there was alfalfa in the row competing with that popcorn. It did make cultivation a little bit tricky. And I think it did put some stress on that crop. I think the in-row competition with the alfalfa was a little bit more than we would have liked. So based on that, Jason came up with the idea, like, I like having this alfalfa between the rows, but can we get rid of what's in the row so that that popcorn has more space right there in the row that's getting established? So what he did was try this strip-till system. So on some fields the following year coming out of alfalfa and clover, we'd flail shred. So let that alfalfa or clover, whatever's there, get some good growth in the spring. Use a flail mower to shred it all the way down. Then make strips with a Hinneker cultivator. So just running the Hinneker cultivator like an inch or two deep. I forget the exact depth that we run that. I think we're using 19-inch sweep. And so essentially severing those alfalfa crowns or clover within the strip where that popcorn row is going to be. Then on most fields, still then made a pass with the Lincoln Rubin, that speed disc, kind of at an angle to the strips that were made with the Hinneker. So we kind of knock back the alfalfa between the rows, but we're not terminating it. In some places, just laid the strips and didn't make the pass. But then, yeah, just planting the popcorn right over those strips. So he's got, you know, RTK, and able to stay right on those strips with the planter. So then we've got a clean strip, popcorn's emerging between the rows, that alfalfa continues to come on. So even though we knock it back with the speed disc, you know, that we hit at an angle to the strips, it doesn't terminate it. So that alfalfa is coming back. We have, you know, popcorn emerging, alfalfa coming on. And so just depending on the field and what the growth is like, if the alfalfa is coming on strong, we can run over it with the flail shredder again. And, you know, it's not going to hurt these tiny little like V1 popcorn plants. So just a way to keep that alfalfa suppressed between the rows. And then another tool we use is a Williston cultivator. And that kind of tears up and beats up and suppresses the alfalfa a little bit. So the idea is just we're allowing that green cover to continue between the rows of popcorn, trying to keep it somewhat suppressed until that popcorn becomes the more dominant plant out there. So that window of time from planting until that popcorn plant is more dominant, you know, it's important to manage, to try to figure out how to manage that alfalfa or clover to keep it from not taking over. So in 2021, it went really well. You know, I think the weather, the moisture, the temperature, everything seemed to favor the popcorn, and had a great experience with it. Good yields, clean fields. 2022, kind of a mixed bag of results. And I think, you know, we're still thinking through what it is that we observed on some of these fields that struggled. We had a really big rainfall event around June 3rd last year, like a 5-inch rainfall event when a lot of the stuff was planted, I think the third into the fourth week of May in terms of popcorn. And then had this big rainfall event when a lot of this stuff was like V1, V2. And, you know, you've got this perennial clover or alfalfa that has a well-established root system, and it was just thriving. But the popcorn, tiny little plant, you know, root system isn't established. We have this big rainfall event. soils go anaerobic, you know, potentially limited root development early from the high soil moisture, saturated soils. And so the, you know, the alfalfa and clover really became dominant in a lot of these. In some cases, I mean, it was like it was almost canopying over the popcorn. And we were delayed in being able to get out there and do field operations to get this alfalfa and clover suppressed between the strips. But we're able to do it. Some of the fields struggled. Some of them did fantastic. And I think it was all probably related to timing of when it was planted relative to this rainfall event.
Yeah, weather impacts everything we found. Could you talk a little bit more about, was there post-planting tillage then or weed management in those strips?
In the strips, no.
Okay. And how was the weed pressure then at the end of the season?
Acceptable. I guess one thing I forgot to, that I failed to mention the last pass. So I talked about, like, you know, we can mow over the crop when it's really small. If we want to mow down that alfalfa and clover in the strips, we can hit it with the Lilliston, which we might do multiple times to kind of rip it up, beat it up, suppress it. And then last pass, we'll go through with the Henniker and undercut those strips. So we're getting some flow of soil into the row. So if there's some weeds in there with the popcorn, can try to get some of those buried.
Do you note any differences between alfalfa versus clover as far as?
Yeah, and that's one thing that we're discussing. And given that it's really just been 2 years, you know, had that 1 year of like minimal tillage alfalfa where it was growing across the whole field, didn't have the strips, then now 2 years of strips into some monoculture alfalfa, into some monoculture clover. This year, we're going to have some mixes. So don't have a good like control variable to say like, and in 1 year, you know, we had great weather, you know, following, you know, at planting and following planting another year with this massive rainfall event. So it's hard to say, you know, was it the clover? Was it the alfalfa? We seem to currently be thinking that planting into a monoculture of alfalfa in this system does better as compared to clover, but not sure. We're going to keep playing with it.
We appreciate that you keep experimenting and sharing your results.
One other thing I'll mention is that's interesting about this is we had some of these fields that were in strip-till popcorn in 21, we had a lot of alfalfa and clover still there the following spring of 22. Mm-hmm. And those fields then went to sunflower. So we got, you know, a second year benefit out of that cover crop to feed that sunflower crop.
That probably made a difference then. I don't know if you compared yields with or without that cover crop.
Yeah, good question. A lot of fields, a lot of data, and not enough time to make sense of it all.
That's what the winter's for. Oh no, winter's over. Time to start.
Yeah. And I'll mention that's one thing to be, I guess, careful of is 2020, where we had that minimum tillage alfalfa field that went to popcorn. After that, we seeded rye and went to a no-till soybean crop in 21. You know, it was great. Let the rye get up tall, planted into a green roller crimp the rye later. Soybeans are coming through. But then what else started to come through? Alfalfa. Wow. It's coming up right through the rye. And it was pretty wet under the mat of rye. We had gotten a rain event. It was real wet. Couldn't get out there. Eventually, we were able to get out there, but the alfalfa was literally starting to like canopy the soybeans. But we're able to get through there with a high residue cultivator, a Henniker, had a front coulter, can slice through that rye, and then the sweeps underneath, we're able to undercut most of that alfalfa between the rows and ended up with a decent crop. But I think this is one of the things we need to think about is what I call compounding in our cropping systems. And those can either be positive compounding or negative compounding. And some of these things, as we're playing with reduced tillage, no tillage, strip tillage, we've got to think about how those things carry over from year to year and really extend our thinking for subsequent years, multiple years of how these things might play out.
Exactly. Yeah, we talked to Levi Lyle last week about his organic no-till. And yeah, it's still, it's a little more than 50-50. I'd say 60-40 for us for success is still working on perfecting it. But the good news is no matter what, you're putting more roots in the ground, you're putting more carbon in the ground, you're leading to less erosion. So, you know, no matter what happens with those cover crops, they're benefiting your system.
Yeah.
So I know we talked a little bit about Andy Klemp because he was on the same docket with you at PFI. Can you talk just for a little bit about how his differs, his strip till system?
Yeah, and I'm not as obviously not as intimate with Andy Klemp's system. It's Klemp Organic Farms up in Wheatfield, Indiana. It's about an hour north of Jason Fetter's operation in Wolcott. And Jason's operation is mostly on loam soils, you know, good organic matter, high CEC. But we do struggle sometimes in the spring with water. You know, these soils holding on to water and not draining. And so getting back into fields can be our challenge. Whereas Andy, he's up closer to Chicago in an area that's all drained out, right? Former kind of wetland area, you know, way back, and very sandy soils, lower organic matter, lower CEC. So for him, he can get into fields quickly, but holding on to nutrients can be challenging, right? And he can get droughty. If it turns hot and dry and it's on a dryland field without irrigation, you know, stuff can burn up. So Andy's cropping is much more intensive in terms of crop rotation, not as many small grains, a lot more corn bean overall in the balance of rotation, but very intensive on cover crop management. And he worked on trying to play with organic no-till corn and soybeans and still had some success with organic no-till beans, but kind of moved on from trying to make organic no-till corn work and started developing strip-till systems, both with corn and soybeans. But in his case, he's not using alfalfa or clover. He's using more annual cover crops, not perennial type. So on soybeans, he's using rye. And then on corn, using things like vetch, crimson clover, annual ryegrass. And he will make strips with an Orthman strip till bar. He also uses a lot of different types of manure. He has a custom manure management business. There's a lot of livestock up in his area, poultry, dairy, hog. His family has the hog operation. And so he's grown a business out of that opportunity in that area. So he'll use all these different types of manure, and he'll actually inject dairy or hog manure under the strips, refreshen the strip, and plant corn on it. And then he's rigged up some equipment, like a, I think he uses Hodson Bickler tine weeder that he rigged up to be able to, where the tines are just on the strip, so he can pull up the tines between the strips. So if he's not in a full tillage situation, he can just tine weed that strip. And I'm trying to think if at some point with cultivation, if he takes out the strip with a row cultivator, I can't recall. But yeah, the specifics of his system, I don't know all the specifics. But again, rather than going into perennial alfalfa and clovers, he's going into annual cover crops, much more intensive management, using the strip till bar, laying down manure under the strip, and managing for weed control right in that strip. Intensive management, but on his light soils, being able to have that cover, I think is pretty important for nutrient management and erosion and keeping the soil covered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds really innovative too. In general, is he happy with the system or is he tweaking it?
Keeping it going. Keeping yep.
That's what we like to hear. Well, you've covered a lot. You've covered how to do it, what the challenges are, what the successes. Is there anything else you want to add to the audience to know more about organic strip till?
I don't want to give the impression that we're not tied to this, right? We're going to continue to play with this strip till system, try to make it work. But in some scenarios, if we come out in the spring with a stand of clover or alfalfa, whatever it might be, and that stand doesn't look good for one reason or another, we will go to full width tillage. So we're not going to stick to this like it's a, you know, we're not dogmatic about it, right? If we have the good stand and conditions are right, we're going to go for it. But if things don't look good for success for that season, we're going to go to plan B and we're going to green manure that whole field and do, you know, full width tillage and cultivation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think being adaptable and flexible, observing what you have there and being willing to change how you're going to manage a given field in a given year, I think is really important.
Good advice. So let's hope the weather helps us get our frost seeding done because we're in the same boat here. Although we're supposed to have snow tomorrow night. So I think we're still in winter here more than you are there. So good luck with the season, and we really appreciate you sharing all your knowledge and information and wishing you the best.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Finally, we move to organic livestock innovations with Brad Hines, who's a professor of animal science at the University of Minnesota, assigned to work on organic dairy research, teaching, and extension. Brad comes from a dairy family and has been working at UM since 2010. He's made tremendous connections with organic dairy folks across the nation, really across the world. And he does an excellent job of keeping up with the latest technologies that may be useful for organic operations. He also has his own podcast called Newsroom. If you Google that and want to tune into, I think he has 50 episodes posted now. Brad, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Sure. Can you tell the audience a little bit more about your job, who you serve, how many organic research projects you have going, and the focus of your research?
Well, I'm a professor of organic dairy production at the University of Minnesota. There are not many of us working in organic livestock, let alone organic dairy production in the U.S., so I'm been very fortunate to work here. Actually, at the University of Minnesota, we have a 300-cow organic dairy at the West Central Research Center, where I'm located in the western part of the state. So I have access to an organic dairy herd for research, and it's really helped me answer a lot of the questions that farmers have been asking me. I guess for our projects, we have so many projects going on that they're quite variable. One is raising calves in an organic situation. So can we raise calves on cows in an organic dairy herd? We're also looking at pain mitigation strategies for dehorning organic calves. We're also trying to increase legumes in pasture dairy herds. Can we increase legumes, and how well does that bode for soil fertility and increase milk production? We're also looking at genetics for organic dairy herds, looking at alternative breeds, some breeds from Europe, also trying to look at the fatty acid profiles of the milk and how we can make a more high quality milk for consumers. We've also sort of ventured into new realms. One is grazing under solar panels. So we've been grazing our organic dairy herd and under solar energy to try and offset some of our energy usage in our organic dairy herd so we can graze cows and produce some solar energy. And I have about 5 graduate students now, all working on organic dairy projects. And, you know, working on all of the projects that I just talked about, they're all doing well and really enjoy working in the organic industry. It gives them something new and something of a challenge to work at. So it's not, you know, kind of the same old projects that people have worked on. So it's been really good to expose graduate students and undergraduate students to organic research.
Excellent. You're a busy man, Brad. I don't know when you sleep. So thank you for doing this podcast. We've had a couple podcasts on precision farming and organic ag, and today we'd like to turn to precision animal agriculture. And I have 3 innovations in mind, Brad, but if we have time, maybe you can talk about others. Let's start with biosensors. Can you talk to us about exactly what they are, how they work, what they measure or monitor, and why would one use them?
Well, we sort of ventured into sensors for cows almost 10 years ago. We were exploring for an organic research project. We wanted to look at the behavior of grazing cows, what happens, you know, when they're eating, fly behavior, you name it. So we originally got our first sensor, and it was a collar-based system. So you put it around the neck of a cow, and it measures their activity level and their rumination. So basically eating behavior aspects. Now, one of the main reasons that organic farms and we started using these was for activity detection or for breeding purposes. So heat detection, being able to find cows in heat. Because with organics, you can't use hormones or anything like that for cows. So you have to rely on natural heats to do that. And sometimes it can be difficult when cows are out to pasture to really see when cows are in heat, when you should breed them. So these sensors have really helped us in our breeding program. We've increased our reproduction in our organic herd here at our research center just by using the one color-based sensor. And I've seen that in other organic herds as well by using some of these sensors. Now, there's a lot more of them. We've ventured into other sensors since that time period. I've moved into an ear tag-based sensor, and that also looks at activity, rumination, eating behavior. Actually, one of my graduate students, Glenda Pereira, she actually was the first person to validate one of the sensors on pasture-based herds. This sensor is known all over the world now, and a lot of actually organic dairy herds have gone to this sensor, and it's working out quite well. It really works well for pasture herds because they're solar receivers. So we have heifers that are 2 miles away from our milking parlor, and we can see what's happening in those heifers by solar receivers. So we know their activity, their rumination. You know, we use it for breeding behavior, detection of health issues, you know, lameness, you name it. We can do that. Those are two sensors. Right now, I have 4 sensors on all of our cows here. Another one that we use is basically a pedometer, and that measures activity of cows, how many steps they take. Some of our cows are taking 60,000 steps per day. I can't imagine taking that many steps ourselves. Another sensor is a rumen bolus. So it goes inside. It's an internal one that measures activity, rumination as well. But it also measures internal body temperature, so we can look at heat stress. And we've used that in a research setting to monitor heat stress of our grazing cows and how we can alleviate heat stress in cows. All of these sensors that we've used are available for organic producers. It probably just matters which one you want to use. They all do about the same thing. Some are a little bit different than others in support and interfaces. But I think that for heat detection, that's number one for organic dairies, and that's really a reason why they should be using them.
Right. Well, how expensive are they, Brad? And then how do you determine if it pays to use them?
Well, that's a good question. They can be expensive. You know, some of these tags and collars that I think of are $150 per tag. Now, they can be reusable. Some of them, you can reuse them. So if you cull a cow or one dies on farm, you can reuse that tag. So, you know, we reuse a lot of the tags. So although they might be expensive up front, I think they pay for themselves in the long run by better fertility. We cull less cows because we get them pregnant based on the activity. So if you ask me, in our herd, they have paid for themselves by getting more animals pregnant and not having to cull so many. You know, now we have so many organic dairy animals, we maybe have generated a few too many here because of our good reproduction from our sensors. So I think they definitely pay for themselves just in activity and health detection. We can detect health issues much quicker than what we used to in the past.
Right. Does sound like they're worthwhile then. Thanks. If you don't mind, we'll move to the next innovation. I'd like to talk to you about robotic milkers. How exactly do they work and how available are they in the U.S.?
So robotic milkers are kind of an interesting aspect from an organic perspective. And I know quite a few organic herds that have gone to robotics. Usually you have one robot and it can milk 60 to 75 cows in a pasture-based herd. A lot of farms have used those to alleviate labor concerns. You know, labor is a big issue in the dairy industry. So farms have gone to robotics to alleviate labor issues. They do a lot of the same things that they have sensors on them too. So you can tell activity, you can tell rumination like the sensors that we talked about earlier. They also measure a lot of different aspects, fat, protein, lactose, somatic cell count. They measure a lot of aspects in the milk for those cows. One of the challenges maybe that farms have is trying to figure out how to graze with them. And there's ways that you can do that. A lot of people feed grain in a robotic system to get the cows back to the robot so they can milk. And there's ways that you can set up your paddocks and pasture systems so cows come and go to the robot a few times a day. You may have to fetch more of the cows from the pasture to come up and milk, but they do work quite well in an organic situation.
Can you back up just a bit and actually literally walk me through it? So I don't think you have a man or a robotic person out there. So it's just a stand, more or less, that they go into and then the robot takes over. How's that work?
Right. It's kind of a, I don't know, envision like a checkout lane at a grocery store. The cow comes up, it kind of holds her in place. Then it has a robotic arm that swings underneath the udder. It washes the cow's teats off for milking, and then it uses some lasers to put the milking teat cups on the udder, and it basically milks the cow out with the robot, and there's no human interaction whatsoever. It, you know, records all of the data, body weights, milking time, and it can refuse the cow too. So if the robot thinks that a cow's coming back too many times during the day, it can open the gate up and send her out without milking her. So there's lots of different ways that a farmer can set up a robot, but it's pretty simple. You know, they can be expensive. They're $150,000 to $175,000 per robot, just for the robot. And you need barn and everything else behind that. So they can be quite expensive, but they save a lot on labor.
Yeah, that's what my next question, similar to the biosensors. How do you determine if it pays to use them? I assume everything's connected to scale, so the larger dairies would possibly use them more than average or smaller sized dairies.
Right. Most of the organic dairies that I've been on have at least two robots. Some have been 4 to 5 robots. Actually, one organic dairy that I know just has one robot and they milk 65 cows, and that's what they want to do. So I think there's a lot of options for organic herds, whether you want one robot or a lot of robots.
Mm-hmm. And do the cows have to get adjusted to it, or do they take to it right away?
It takes some adjustment. It's really different, especially getting cows to, you know, remember to go milk themselves versus somebody coming and taking them to the milking parlor all of the time. You know, training takes a week or more to do that. I've helped on a few conventional dairies train their cows in robots. And the first couple of days, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to get those cows in. And it's just different because there's no human contact. It's all this, you know, robotic arm doing everything. So it can be a little challenging for some cows, but most of them adjust quite well within a week.
And then is the process for filling the tank similar to a regular dairy? It goes from the catchment of the robot to tanks?
Yep, very similar. All the milk flows through the robot into the bulk tank with no problem.
Maybe you can demo it one of your field days.
Exactly.
Thanks. Okay, the last one I have in mind is your really cool cow vac that I saw at your research station, a non-spray method to manage flies in organic dairies. Can you walk us through, no pun intended, how the cow vac works, please?
Sure. You know, we've been using the cow vac for 7 or 8 years now. Started it out with an organic research project to control flies on pasture. So it's pretty simple. Cows kind of walk through a chute, kind of a lane, and they walk into the cow vac, and there's kind of some blowers that blow across their stomach to blow the flies off, and it sucks them up on the other side. And then as they walk through it, there's some fans that suck the flies off the top of their back as they walk through. And so the cows like to walk through it. It does control the flies. In our research project, we showed that every time a cow walks through there, it captures 60% of the flies on the cows. It's not perfect, but it captures a lot of flies. So we still use it here at our research center. We have two of them. Our cows walk through it twice a day before they go into the milking parlor. It's really helped to control the flies. I've worked with other organic dairy herds that have these cow vacuums that they like it. A lot of them that have utilized them like it. There's actually a farmer that I worked with in Northeast Iowa that has one, and he likes it and uses it quite often for his herd as well.
That's cool. Is it run on electricity? I forgot to ask you that.
It does run on electricity. Yeah, there's 110 or 240. Typically, it's pretty easy to install these. Usually they install them near the milking parlor. So when the cows come in for milking, they walk through the system. Actually, I had one on a research project. I had one at a robotic dairy. So every time the cows come up for milking to the robot, they walk through the cow vacuum. That cow vacuum is still there on the robotic dairy. They love it for their cows on in their robots.
Excellent. So my usual question, how expensive are they? And do they pay off quite rapidly or just take a while?
You know, the initial sticker shock is always a concern for farmers. They're about $8,000. However, me and my colleague in entomology figured if we can get a 2-pound increase in milk production, it pays for itself in 1 year just by increasing milk production from flies. On some farms that we've worked with, we have seen a 2 to 3 pound increase in milk production just by controlling the flies with our cow vacuum. So it does pay for themselves. If you can control the flies, it will pay for itself in 1 year. No problem.
That sounds like a good deal. I forgot to ask, does it help with disease management too? Are there any of these flies vectors of disease?
Some of the flies can be vectors for disease, pink eye, mastitis. The biggest one is it just causes nuisance, you know, it bites them. And, you know, there's a lot of behavioral aspects that go along with it more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Just being irritated.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent. Well, we've covered a lot of innovations today, Brad. Is there any other ones you want to address?
You know, one that I've been working on with some organic farmers as well as automatic calf feeders. So it's kind of a technology. So it's kind of like the robot system, but you're feeding your calves automatically with a machine. And we're doing that for labor purposes as well. And an organic farmer gave me the idea. He's like, well, why don't you figure out how to put one in, get some money to put one in, and then tell us if it works or not. So it was really an idea from an organic farmer, and I've done it and used it quite well. And it does, I wouldn't say it saves a lot of labor, it shifts labor, but it has worked. And we're continuing to explore automatic calf feeding in the future. So it, one day, you know, the dairies might be all automated. Whether that's a good thing or not, I guess time will tell.
Right. I'm sure the organic guys will say, even if you add all these innovations, it's imperative that you continue to remain in close contact with your herd.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. You just, because you have all these sensors and robots and feeders doesn't mean that you should walk away. That's probably the wrong thing. You need to still look at your animals and see them every day or twice a day or more to see how they're doing. Otherwise, yeah, these things can become disasters really fast if you just avoid them.
So the primary purpose is to help alleviate the issue we have with lack of labor. But
yes, that's the big reason is labor efficiency. It's only going to become more of an issue as we move into the future.
I'm sad to say that's probably true. Well, thank you so much, Brad. Thanks for sharing all your information.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been great.
This is Kathleen Dellett signing off on our Innovations in Organic Ag podcast. Thank you for listening.
This program is brought to you by Iowa State University Extension and Outreach. This institution is an equal opportunity provider. For the full non-discrimination statement or accommodation inquiries, go to www.extension.iastate.edu/diversity/ext.